This is the third in a series of four Jubilee Centre talks given by Dr. Roy Clement at the Westminster Cathedral Hall in London. The talk is entitled Total Quality Relationships, Fresh Perspectives on Intimacy and Friendship, and is introduced by Dr. Michael Schluter, Director of the Jubilee Centre.
Roy Clements, the speaker, I think is known to many of you. He has a background which is from the area of science, did a PhD at Imperial College London in physical chemistry or chemical physics. One or the other, I'm never quite sure if these are the same thing, but they're probably not. And I met him when we were out in Nairobi about 22, 23 years ago, and he was pastor of a Baptist church over there, which I attended for 4 years with him as the minister. And since that time, I think I've been working with him on a number of areas, looking at areas of public life and how theology and philosophy impact upon them. This is the third talk in the series. In the first one, for those who weren't here, we looked at the contemporary message of popular culture. And then 2 weeks ago from tonight, we looked at the impact of technology on people's relationships. And tonight, the subject is total quality relationships, fresh perspectives on intimacy and friendship. So I think without further ado, I'll hand over to Roy Clements. Thank you, Roy.
As far as I can work out, when I was at Imperial, they're not far from here, the real difference between physical chemistry and chemical physics has to do with, A, who pays the research grant, the chemistry department or the physics department, and B, which journal you publish your results in, the Journal of Chemical Physics or the Journal of Physical Chemistry. Well, since physical chemistry paid the chemistry department paid the research grant, but the results are published in the chemical of in the Journal of Chemical Physics, nobody's ever quite clear which category I belong to. You can have everything in the world and still be the loneliest man in it. That is the most bitter type of loneliness. Success has brought me world idolization and millions of pounds, but it has prevented me from having the one thing we all need. A loving relationship. Those are the words of Freddie Mercury. Some of you may remember he was the lead singer in the group Queen. He died in 1991 of AIDS. Those words were from a newspaper interview he gave in the year of his death. I don't suppose many of us here would want to endorse Freddie Mercury's lifestyle, which was pretty bizarre. But I do believe that in that rather embittered interview which he gave, he was speaking for many people, nevertheless. People who are neither rich nor famous, nor indeed bisexual or promiscuous as he was, but who find it as impossible as Freddie Mercury did to discover the quality of personal relationship that they feel they need, and whose lives are impoverished as a result of that. Sigmund Freud, in his book Civilizations and Its Discontents, suggests that it isn't just individuals that are vulnerable to mental illness. He says that sometimes whole societies, whole cultures, are victim to a kind of collective neurosis. And it was Freud's view that Western society was going to generate such pathological, neurotic conditions in the future. Many more recent authors are convinced his prediction has come true in that respect. There is, they suggest, a pandemic sickness in the emotional life of modern Western men and women. It shows itself in the prevalence of anxiety and depression. It shows itself in the statistics of divorce and suicide and drug abuse and juvenile crime. But perhaps most distinctively, though most difficult to quantify, it shows itself in the superficiality of personal relationships. Just a few quotes. First from Eric Fromm in his book The Sane Society. There is not much love to be found in the world of today. There is rather a superficial friendliness concealing a distance, an indifference, a subtle distrust. R.D. Lang in The Politics of Experience. We are born into a world these days where social alienation awaits us. Before we can even ask such optimistic questions as what is a personal relationship, we have first to settle if relationships are even possible in the present situation. Karen Horney, quite a well-known psychotherapist, in her book The Neurotic Personality of Our Time: the average individual today, even when he has many contacts with others and is happily married, nevertheless feels comparatively emotionally isolated. He is caught in the dilemma of hungering for a great deal of affection and yet finding great difficulty in finding it. Now, these are all writers who spend a great deal of time, actually, in dealing with individuals and thinking about cultural analysis. Maybe it's Christopher Lasch's best-selling book, The Culture of Narcissism, there, which puts it best. Our society has made lasting friendships, love affairs and marriages increasingly difficult to achieve. Social life has become more and more warlike, and personal relationships have taken on the nature of combat. Some dignify the combat by offering courses in assertiveness training. Others celebrate the impermanent attachments that result with slogans like the open marriage. But in doing so, they merely intensify the dissatisfaction with the quality of human relationships, which is at the heart of our problem. Now, I don't know if the phrase is superficial friendship, social alienation, emotional isolation, pervasive dissatisfaction with the quality of human relationships. I don't know whether that rings any bells for you. It certainly does for me, both as an individual and as someone who's involved somewhat in pastoral counselling. Many, many people in our culture today do not really understand experientially, firsthand, the meaning of words like community or intimacy. How on earth has this come about? Well, interestingly, all the writers I have quoted agree that in one way or another, it's attributable to the rise of liberal capitalism. Now, before all those on the right here walk out in protest that they didn't realise this was going to be a political meeting, let me hasten to say, there is a great deal about the rise of capitalism that we can and ought to be immensely positive about, in my view. Capitalism has unleashed enormous productive potential, something which Marx himself was quick to acknowledge. In fact, if it hadn't been for the technological and economic development which capitalism has fostered, then I suspect the doomsday scenario of Thomas Malthus would quite probably have proven true a century ago, and food supplies would have been outstripped by population growth. Yet even those of us who are the most sympathetic towards capitalism, I think, know deep down, if we're honest, that there are negative features in it. And it's those negative features, or one set of those negative features, that these authors are concerned to highlight for us. Of course, the negative features of capitalism that we're probably most aware of these days, because of pressure groups like the Green Movement, have to do with the impact of capitalism on our physical environment. The irresponsible consumption of non-renewable fossil fuels, the devastation of the rainforests, the filling of the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, etc., etc. And I'd be the last person to suggest those aren't real dangers that need to be addressed. However, my own view, and perhaps here I betray my optimistic scientific mindset, my own view is that those kinds of problems almost certainly can be successfully addressed. Indeed, I suspect that the very wealth which capitalism produces will be important in financing the solutions. Far more dangerous, in my view, and far less tractable as a problem, are the social consequences of capitalism. Subtly, in my view, liberal capitalism has generated a new kind of culture in which high-quality personal relationships are far harder to experience, far harder to obtain. Behind this lie two philosophical assumptions, which very subtly, by a kind of drip-feed mechanism, liberal capitalism has fostered over the last 100 years or 200 years, both of which are decidedly inimical inimical to personal relationships. The first is materialism, and the second, individualism. Let me deal with materialism first. Now, in its pure philosophical form, what materialism says is that material things are the only real things. There is nothing else but material things. The logical corollary of that is that material things are really the only things worth pursuing. That means that the queen of the sciences can't be theology, as the medieval philosophers thought. It has to be economics, as our new classical economics kinds of philosophers think. The measure of the meaningfulness of life, the success of life, can only be defined in terms of material acquisitiveness. Now, of course, you don't have to be a materialist if you're a capitalist. Free market forces don't necessarily drive spirituality out of the world. In fact, of course, Adam Smith was a vicar. And there are plenty of people in the City of London today very committed to capitalism, who I'm delighted to say pray daily. Nevertheless, I think we do have to confess that capitalism tends to promote materialistic values in all kinds of ways. Of course, it's not the only social force to do this. Karl Marx was a far more self-conscious materialist than the Victorian capitalists he denounced ever were. But there can be no question, I think, at least for us in the West, capitalism has generated a consumerist, acquisitive approach to life which measures success almost solely in material terms. Maybe I can illustrate it with what I call an everyday story of materialistic folk. John and Jean were getting married. "We'll find a little place of our own," says Jean excitedly. "Anywhere with you would be a palace," said John romantically. So they bought their first home. It was rather little. Two up, two down, Victorian terrace with a bathroom built on at the back and a garden the size of a postage stamp at the front. But the nice man at the bank was only too happy to lend them the money. And they were happy there. For a while. "I really could do with a bigger kitchen," said Jean, hopefully. "And when Junior arrives, there'll be nowhere for your mother to stay," sighed John, resignedly. So they moved to a bigger house. 3-bedroom, semi-detached this time, with a proper upstairs bathroom and a much bigger kitchen. And the nice man at the bank was only too happy to lend them the money, and they were happy there. For a while. "This really isn't a nice part of town," said Jean disgruntledly. "Little George isn't making the right sort of friends at play school." "Fred at the office has just bought a place on the other side of the railway," replied John enviously. "They all have built-in garages and double glazing over there." So they bought a new house on the other side of the railway. 3-bedroom semi again, but it was a much nicer neighbourhood, and it did have a built-in garage and double glazing, and the nice man at the bank was only too happy to lend them the money, and they were happy there. For a while. "Have you seen what they're doing next door?" said Jean indignantly. "A loft extension and a conservatory?" "Fred at the office has just done the same," replied John wearily. "He says it makes much more room, and of course it adds to the value of the house." So they built a loft extension and a conservatory. It meant young George had somewhere to keep his hi-fi, and his snooker table, and his computer, and Jean had somewhere for her houseplants. And the nice man at the bank was only too happy to lend them the money, and they were happy there. For a while. "Have you seen that new estate they're building down by the river?" asked Jean inquiringly. "I was saying to Fred only the other day," replied John superiorly. "Now I've got that promotion, we'll be looking for somewhere a little more exclusive to stay." So they moved to a new residence on the new estate, 5 bedrooms, detached, twin bathroom, double garage, 3/4 acre plot, with a huge swimming pool and a delightful waterside location, with even mooring facilities for George's yacht. And they were happy again. For a while. Now, please don't understand me. There is nothing wrong with property. There is nothing wrong with upward mobility. There is nothing wrong with aspiring to improve your standard of living. But would you not agree with me that there is a spirit abroad in our culture, cultivated, I think, by the value system of our capitalistic economic system, that never actually knows when to say enough is enough? That pursues contentment like a will-o'-the-wisp, with expectations always out of reach. There, little luxury, don't you cry, you'll be a necessity by and by. Happiness for many people, in my experience, is the futile pursuit of more and more possessions. And of course, our human relationships are somehow embedded into this ever-escalating material expectations, and often take second place to them. I'm tempted to speculate about what has happened to relationships in John and Jean's life during this pilgrimage to prosperity that they have pursued. Are they, I wonder, as close to one another now as they were when they were first married and bought that little two-up, two-down terraced house? Or have they, as I have often observed, drifted apart into, what was it from called it? Superficial friendliness. Could it be that John has to spend so much time at his office these days he knows his secretary better than he does Jean? Is it possible that Jean has become one of those suburban wives who privately longs for the rediscovery of romance and intimacy as she watches the ersatz love affairs on the afternoon TV soap opera? And what about George? What kind of relationships does George have, for instance, with his father? Maybe again you've heard this folk song. My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking before I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm going to be like you, Dad. I'm going to be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When are you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll have a good time then, son. You know, we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I've got lots to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away, and his smile never dimmed, and he said, I'm going to be like him, yeah. I'm going to be like him. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When are you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then, son. You know we'll have a good time then. Well, he came home from college just the other day. So much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while? He shook his head and said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later. Can I have them, please? And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and man in the moon. When are you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. Well, I've long since retired, and my son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle, and the kids have the flu. But it's been sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. The pursuit of materialistic aspirations is, without question, in my view, stealing the time and the energy necessary to form strong family bonds from a great many people. And the more embedded they are in capitalist free enterprise and the values which that engenders in our society, the more vulnerable they are to those pressures, in my experience. And more people in our society are suffering from the neurotic consequences of emotional deprivation and social inadequacy as a result. Like Freddie Mercury, they are being sent into the world ill-equipped to find that which all of us most fundamentally need for our human happiness: a loving personal relationship. Materialism, then, that's the first way, it seems to me, that capitalism has done its damage in this particular area of our social experience, of our culture. The other pressure I identified, the other influence, was individualism, you remember. Now, if materialism fastens upon things, individualism is preoccupied with the self. My goals, my interests, the first person singular pronoun. I have an inalienable right to pursue my self-fulfillment. That's what I mean by individualism. Interestingly, many cultural analysts who've looked at this side of things have taken the Greek myth of Narcissus as a tool of social analysis. You probably know this story. Narcissus was an astonishingly beautiful youth, according to Greek mythology, who was passionately loved by the river nymph Echa. But he spurned her and became infatuated instead by his own reflection, mirrored in the still water of a spring. So Narcissus has become the archetypal symbol of that most ironic of all forms of idolatry, the worship of one's own self-image. They both pine away, both he and Echa, in the tragedy of their unfulfilled devotion. Freud was the first person, I think again, to pick up on this myth and use it in the way I'm suggesting. He noted in some of his clients a pathological preoccupation with the self, a particular form of personality disorder which he characterized by the word narcissism. And that word has been carried into post-Freudian tradition and used a great deal in the last century as a tool of social analysis. Many writers, not necessarily Freudians, have broadened that term and used it to describe what they see as the selfishness and the individualism which lies at the root of so many of our social problems. Eric Fromm, of course, is another one, who in his book The Heart of Man has done precisely that. Many psychotherapists in this school have pointed out the prevalence of what they call narcissistic types of disorder in the population. Some would even argue that whereas in Freud's day the preeminent kind of symptom which psychiatrists had to deal with were related to hysteria, the main sorts of problems which psychotherapists have to deal with today are resulted to narcissistic injury, as they would call it. Some distortion in the development of probably the growing child or the young adolescent, which results in this kind of preoccupation with themselves. And quite a number would suggest that some of the most troubling features of our society are can be put down to this fundamentally unsatisfying and antisocial disorder of our social psychology. Well, again, it will come as no surprise to you that most of the authors who talk in this way put capitalism and its rise down as one of the reasons that has led to the prevalence of this kind of narcissistic mindset. Eric Fromm is typical of the way that the argument proceeds. He suggests that it is fundamental to human need to be loved. He says we all fundamentally need to experience love. We cannot survive with it. It is the oxygen of our humanity. But he says capitalism, in non-deliberate but nevertheless very effective ways, functions to suffocate love. In at least three ways, he says. First, it cultivates the mentality that you only get what you deserve. But he says, if you think that way, you reduce love to mere admiration. Whereas he insists real love must be experienced as an unconditional acceptance. Secondly, he says, capitalism encourages self-interest as a virtue. But with that mindset on board, love is reduced to an exercise in manipulation designed to obtain gratification of my own physical and emotional needs, my self-interest. Whereas he says real love must be experienced as essentially altruistic. And thirdly, he says, capitalism encourages the market concept of value. That is, a thing is worth only what people are prepared to pay for it. But buy into that concept too much, he says, and you reduce love to a mere contract for mutual advantage. Love is a mercenary calculation for mutual benefit. But he insists true love can't be experienced in that way. Now, one has to say that some of the more libertarian capitalists have been rather unashamed in confirming Fromm's suspicions on this score in their writings. I'm thinking of someone, for instance, like Ayn Rand in the book The Fountainhead. That's what she says. Civilization is progress towards privacy. The savage's whole existence is in public, trapped in the prison of family, tribe, and caste. But under capitalism, man is free to choose whom he will associate with, whom he will value, and whom he will befriend. This implies, she says, that under capitalism, men must earn the social relationships they desire. Well, that's precisely what Fromm says it does mean, and what he objects to. Or Nathaniel Brandon, one of Ayn Rand's disciples. What does it mean to be loved for oneself, he asks indignantly. Rationally, it can only mean to be valued for the virtues one has achieved in one's character. Love, he says, is the emotional price paid by one person for the joy he receives from the virtues of another. Notice the capitalistic language there? The emotional price you pay for the benefits you obtain from somebody else. Then he goes on, love without admiration, he says, is a moral blank check. It can't be a charitable gift, he says. Love must be a tribute. So I say they are quite unashamed of this, what Fromm would say, was a commercialization of love as a very idea. And I have to say, though I think very few people would go as far as Ayn Rand and Brandon in articulating it, it does seem to me, from my observation of people and of life, that there has to be something in this. This kind of attitude, this more commercial attitude, this more individualistic, self-centered attitude, does seem to me more characteristic of our culture than it used to be, and it is undermining the depth of relationships. It cannot do anything else. People cannot possibly trust one another in the profound way that they used to if they see relationships in this rather more commercial, self-centered way. Let me give just two examples from writers who have argued in precisely this way. Herbert Hendin is a sociologist who in the very end of the 70s and early 80s did a psychological study on students in the USA, particularly regarding personal relationships, and his book and his work was later published under the title The Age of Sensation. This is a paragraph from it. This culture, he says, is marked by self-interest and egocentrism, which reduces all relationships to the question, what can I get out of it? Society's fascination, he says, with self-aggrandizement makes young people judge all relationships in terms of winning or losing points. The scale of values against which both sexes tend to measure relationships is solitary self-gratification. That was the rather shocking conclusion he came to. A book which rather confirms his results, though, again from the early 80s, a research group of sociologists in the University of Berkeley published their work titled The Habits of the Heart. They were looking at the difference or the tension in contemporary American society between individualistic freedom on the one hand and social commitment on the other. And The Habits of the Heart is the report of their analysis. One of the things which they identify, they call the growth of the therapeutic attitude. Let me try and explain what they mean by that. They observed that people's attitude to feelings fell into two very distinct categories today. People with older and more traditional ideas, not necessarily older by the clock, but older and more traditional ideas, took the view that personal feelings should take second place to social duty. Hence, a high value was placed on virtues like self-control, self-denial, self-discipline, and self-sacrifice. Marital love, typically in this group, was viewed as commitment of the will, which one ought to honour irrespective of whether one's personal feelings about it were good or bad. But the researchers discovered that this traditional attitude was very rapidly being displaced by what they characterised as the therapeutic attitude. On this view, feelings take priority over everything else. The important issues are not, or the important virtues are not those which restrain the expression of the self, but rather those which liberate it. Honesty, openness, these are what really count, they say. Not self-discipline, self-denial, self-control, or self-sacrifice, but self-realization, self-fulfillment, self-acceptance, self-actualization. That phrase actually comes from Maslow. These are the buzzwords of the therapeutic attitude. The spontaneous sharing of feelings between authentic expressive individuals, this is the therapeutic ideal of love. And long-term commitment does not necessarily feature in such a relationship at all. According to the therapeutic attitude, if my emotional needs are not being met by my partner, I am entitled to sever the relationship. The therapeutic attitude denies all form of social obligation or social duty and replaces it with these ideals of open and honest communication. So the only thing a therapeutically liberated lover owes to his or her partner, according to this book, Habits of the Heart, is to share his feelings fully with them. Emotional independence and self-sufficiency are the goal, and a personal relationship is simply seen as a device for achieving this essentially individualistic goal. Now, these are professional sociologists with no particular axe to grind. They are simply reporting their observations of social attitudes as their research identified them. But, of course, they're no surprise. Georgia Neer O'Neill's book, The Open Marriage, has already said it. Fidelity, they said, must be redefined as commitment to one's own growth, not as sexual bondage to another person. And you see the essentially individualistic philosophy that underlies such a statement. And I suggest that individualistic mindset, whilst it is not a necessary consequence of capitalism, you don't automatically think that way because you live in a capitalistic economic system. Nevertheless, one has to say, I think, that capitalism has tended to foster that kind of individualism by the very kind of people it rewards, the very kind of virtues it extols. Fromm is not so far wide of the mark when he says that by encouraging the theory that you only get what you deserve, that self-interest is a virtue, and that the only way you value a thing is by what the market will pay for it. By cultivating those kinds of presuppositions in our mind, these kinds of more individualistic considerations gain dominance in our minds. Well, how are we to respond to such a situation? I would hope that most of us would at least be concerned that the quality of human relationships is decaying, that more and more people are complaining about this, that more and more people, in fact, are running to counsellors and psychotherapists seeking to do something about it. People are today, I think, very hungry for a better quality of relationships. It's not that we don't know people. We rub shoulders with dozens of people every day. It's just the quality of intimate involvement with people and trust in people just isn't there in the way that we really long for it to be. If capitalism is really the demon, maybe we should try and turn the clock back. Well, sadly, I think that's not politically possible, economically possible, and even if it were, I'm not sure it's desirable. I'm not sure that the losses do so far outweigh the pluses of capitalism that we ought to suggest that capitalism is an essential evil. We could spend a long while talking about the good things capitalism has made possible in our world, not the least feeding the hungry, as I said earlier. In any case, as I've tried to say again and again, there is no inescapable connection between a capitalistic system and these two philosophical presuppositions which have got somehow embedded into our culture. It is possible to counteract the philosophical presuppositions without abandoning the economics. But if you're going to do that, you have to give consideration to questions of religion and ideology that are informing your culture. And that, I would like to suggest to you, is actually the real root of our problem. There has been a tragic coincidence in the last couple of hundred years. As capitalism has advanced, so our Christian heritage has declined. It is, I say, a tragic coincidence, because the growth of capitalism has really made the value system which our Christian heritage sustained increasingly indispensable. In our Judeo-Christian heritage in this country, we have a very rich philosophy of relationships. It lies there in the Old Testament, for instance, in the whole concept of covenant. Any of you who are Jewish here will know how central the thought of covenant is to the Hebrew religion. I was speaking this morning on the book of Ruth, which is one of the most delightful books in the whole of the Bible. And it's a book all about relationships. Ruth is a young woman who is given a choice in the first chapter. She has lost her husband. She comes from Moab. She is not a Jew. She can, if she wishes, a mother-in-law permits it, go back to Moab and find a husband there. It is clearly in the line of her own self-interest to do so. Her mother-in-law is going back to Judah. There is no possibility, humanly speaking, that Ruth, a woman from Moab, is going to find a Jewish husband in that land. No self-respecting Jew would marry a foreigner in his own homeland. And yet, extraordinarily, Ruth makes the decision to stay with Naomi, her mother-in-law. "Wherever you go, I will go," she says. "Where you die, I will die." It is a most moving and extraordinary commitment of love that Ruth makes to a rapidly aging widow woman, to whom, humanly speaking, she does not owe a great deal. She is, after all, her mother-in-law, and her husband is dead. Why does she do it? What's the story about? The story is about how covenant love humanizes society. For this is a story set in the time of the Judges, one of the most brutal, anarchistic periods in the entire history of Israel. And like a little jewel set in the mud, here is Ruth, a pagan woman, believe it or not, demonstrating to the Jewish nation what covenant love, the sort of love they should know more about than anybody else in the world, is like. Being committed to people and putting them first, even at cost to yourself. I commend the story to you if you've never read it. That value informs the whole of Old Testament religion. It's the thing which the prophets most often complain about when they chide Israel and warn her of judgment. "There is no covenant love in the land," says Hosea. "That's why the land mourns." And of course, when we come to the New Testament and to Jesus, we find essentially that same emphasis in his teaching. What's the greatest commandment, they ask him? "You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbour as yourself," he replies. These, of course, are Old Testament answers. He's very deliberately not saying anything new. He doesn't claim to be a moral innovator. He only claims in his person to represent in a fresh and living way that covenant love which the Old Testament had always known was God's supreme virtue. Many times in his parables, he illustrates, just as beautifully as that story of Ruth does in the Old Testament, what such love means. In his story of the rich man and Lazarus, for instance. Appropriate to our critique of capitalism, here is a wealthy man, a very wealthy man, who misses the opportunity to form a relationship with a poor man at his gate. And, says Jesus, he pays an eternal price for that omission. He may have been rich materially, but relationally he was poverty-stricken. And when God judged him, it was the relational richness of his life he was more concerned about than how much money he had in the bank. Love God and love for neighbor, these are the chief commands. His famous story of the Good Samaritan is another example, isn't it? Two men going along the road, both of them religious men, actually. But they miss the opportunity to love an injured victim of a crime. And astonishingly, a mongrel Samaritan shows them up. We could multiply examples like that from Jesus' teaching, but perhaps it is not his teaching, actually, which for the Christian is the crucial thing. For certainly the Christian would want to insist that Jesus, supremely, in the person he was and in the thing he came to do in his death on the cross, puts relationships at the highest possible level of God's agenda. The Bible says he came specifically to reconcile human beings to God. Where a relationship had broken down, he came to re-cement it. Indeed, more than that, by his very coming, he has revealed to us what before we never knew. That God himself is not an isolated monad, like the Allah of Islam. That God himself is a complex, interpersonal deity, that there is personal relationship even within God. A union of persons in love. Well, as I say, I want to say a great deal more about that next week. But suffice it at this point simply to say, I think it's very tragic that Freddie Mercury never discovered a loving relationship. But I think it's even more tragic that more and more people, as our 20th century turns into the 21st century, are going to be making the same complaint. And I do not think we can turn the clock back on the erosion which has been generally done to our culture in this respect unless we rediscover that Judeo-Christian heritage as before it's too late. Well, thank you very much, Roy.